Thank you, everyone, and welcome. I'm Larry Mohn, president of the Manhattan Institute, and I'm very pleased. I'm very pleased to welcome you to our 20th annual Walter Wriston Lecture, named after a man who believed in the importance of ideas and walked his talk every single day of his life. And it's a very simple program. For the next hour, all you have to do is enjoy the company of your companions at dinner. And at 8:30, we'll start a formal program with our very distinguished speaker, George Weigel. We're looking forward to it, and we're glad you could all join us. Thank you for coming.
Boy, that worked.
I am Dietrich Weissmann, chairman of the Manhattan Institute, and thank you for coming tonight. Thank you. I would like to start by thanking Larry Mohn and his terrific staff for putting this wonderful evening together. And I've had the privilege of sitting next to Joan and George Weigel, and I think we're going to have a very interesting evening. The Manhattan Institute believes in the power of ideas. And we gather at our Wriston Lecture each year to celebrate them. Well, the good ones, at least. Walter Wriston, for which this lecture is named, was a former chairman of Citicorp and a long-serving Manhattan Institute trustee, and one of the best, by the way. With this annual lecture, we seek to inform and enrich the intellectual debate surrounding the great public issues of our day. When you come right down to it, that is the job of a think tank, to offer up good ideas and expose the bad ones. And for more than a quarter century, the Manhattan Institute has been extraordinarily effective in doing just that. Throughout the Institute's history, we have found that a well-researched, well-written book is the best way to spread a good idea. Books have permanence. They become a reference point, and they can set in motion intellectual realignments that ultimately lead to political and cultural change. For example, Charles Murray's book, Losing Ground, forever changed the national discourse on welfare reform. Peter Huber's book, Judging Science, has helped to rid junk science from America's courtrooms. George Kelling's book, Fixing Broken Windows, has transformed the practice of policing that has led to dramatic reductions in crime nationwide. We believe that we have another such paradigm shifting work before us now. Dr. David Graetzer's new book, The Cure, How Capitalism Can Save American Healthcare. In the book, Dr. Graetzer not only diagnoses the myriad ailments afflicting American healthcare, but prescribes a series of sensible, pragmatic, free market solutions. Among many positive reviewers, Milton Friedman has called the book a well-written, interesting, yet authoritative, and thorough account of what is wrong with medicine today and how to cure American healthcare. Heading into the 2008 elections, healthcare is sure to be one of the most important issues on the domestic agenda, and with David's new book as our guide, the Manhattan Institute intends to play a major role in shaping the debate. Turning to another area that needs, or perhaps more appropriately, cries out for reform, universities used to be places where ideas were openly discussed and debated. However, as Princeton University professor Robert George explained at last year's Riston lecture, universities have become places where free speech and thought are often suppressed. Robbie George's stirring words had quite an impact that night. And I am pleased to report that the Manhattan Institute has now decided to launch a new program, the Center for the American University, whose mission will be to help bring serious scholarship and intellectual diversity back to the college campus. Thank you. Thank you. Dr. James Pearson has come on as a senior fellow to help launch this new center, and the Manhattan Institute's executive vice president, David DeRozier, has also joined the program as a senior fellow. As part of this effort, the Institute has created the Higher Education Reform Fund. The goal is to help support academics at American universities that are following the Robbie George model. And by the way, the Education Reform Fund, it may not be unique. I'm not really sure about this. David would know. It may be unique, but it's certainly unusual in that it will be a completely open organization, which actually means that anybody who wants to contribute can do so. And even more importantly, anybody who wants to get involved with a college or any kind of an educational situation that might benefit by money and brains would be able to do so through this through this organization. Finally, I want to take a moment to acknowledge a man who, by shaping the world of ideas, has tangibly changed the world that we live in. That man is Myron Magnitt, editor of the City Journal. Where are you, Myron? Where are you? Stand up and take a bow. Over the past 13 years, the ideas promulgated by Myron and the talented team that he has assembled at City Journal have changed this city and this country more than anyone could have possibly imagined. America's mayor, Rudy Giuliani, acknowledged as much when he spoke at our Hamilton dinner this spring and said, quote, "If there was a charge of plagiarism for political programs, I'd probably be in a lot of trouble because I think we plagiarize most of them, if not all of them, from the pages of the City Journal." As some of you already know, at the end of this year, Myron will hand over the reins to the gifted Brian Anderson. Brian, want to stand up so everybody can see who you are? Thank you. We are pleased that Myron will remain on as editor at large, and as such, will continue to provide intellectual input into the City Journal and serve as a frequent contributor to its pages. In fact, this move will free Myron up to do even more writing And I personally can't wait to read all the wonderful pieces that I am absolutely sure will come forth from his prolific pen. Myron has built City Journal into the most elegant, well-written, and influential public journal in this country. He has helped to transform New York City and ignite a renaissance of cities from coast to coast, and he has helped to turn compassionate conservatism into a national governing philosophy. Please join me in acknowledging the extraordinary contributions of this extraordinary man. Now I will turn the proceedings over to the esteemed Peggy Noonan, who will introduce our 2006 Riston Lecturer. As you probably all know, Peggy is the best-selling author of, let me think, 7 books on American politics, history, and culture. Her most recent book, John Paul the Great, Remembering a Spiritual Father, was published by Viking last November. Peggy's writing appears regularly on the pages of the nation's most prestigious newspapers and magazines, and she is a frequent guest on political talk shows. Perhaps most of us are familiar with Peggy through her through her role as a contributing editor of the Wall Street Journal and a weekly columnist for the journal's editorial page website. She is also, I am honored to say, a valued trustee of the Manhattan Institute. Please join me in welcoming Peggy Noonan.
Hello, good evening. Thank you, Dick, very much. I thank you for your kind words as you make your way back to your seat there. Dick, I found your introduction almost embarrassingly flattering, but that's because I wrote it, so please. Walter Mondale used to say thank you for lovely words when he was introduced by saying, I don't deserve your kind words, but then I have arthritis and I don't deserve that either. I am honored to speak here this evening. I have been a member and supporter of the Manhattan Institute for I think just about a dozen years. It is a group close to my heart, a group that is greatly worth supporting, and a group that is a famous success in America, which is not a bad thing to be. I am also very honored to be here specifically tonight to say a few words at the 2006 Riston Lecture for our Riston Lecturer. This is our great annual event at the Manhattan Institute. Our speaker this evening is now part of a tradition that goes back to a youngish man called Rupert Murdoch speaking on the Battle of Wapping in Great Britain. It goes back to Tom Wolfe on the great hog-stomping drama that is the United States of America in the modern era. It includes Chief Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court and the search for justice. It included, I remember most memorably, almost V.S. Naipaul on the impact on modern consciousness of the rise of the city, especially of the great and glittering cities of the West. Our Wriston lecturer this evening is very much in that great tradition. He is a deeply respected social thinker, as all of you know, and he is one of our country's leading commentators on religion and public life. He happens to be the author of the definitive biography of John Paul II, Witness to Hope. When it came out to very great and deserved acclaim. His two most recent books are God's Choice, Pope Benedict and the Future of the Catholic Church, and The Cube and the Cathedral, Europe, America, and Politics Without God. I suspect this evening that George may spend a moment or two speaking about Europe and America, about the gulf that increasingly has come to seem to divide us, about the clash of temperaments that has come, I think, to some degree to mark our relationship. I think from the perspective of Europe, some of the new distance is perhaps captured by a question posed to me by a friend in France. He was a Frenchman a few years ago. He was teasing me, and he said, "So, Peggy, what is the difference between America and milk?" I said, "I wasn't really sure." He said, "Well, if you leave milk alone long enough, it eventually develops culture." This attitude has been countered in recent years by another reference to dairy products, and that would be the famous cheese-eating surrender monkeys. In fairness, be good. In fairness to French views, I should note that Dick Weissman and I were slightly late this evening in starting the program. The reason is that we had gone over, we were in the next room where we're listening to a report, a news report from CNN. Congress had apparently just released a report saying the government of Iraq is incompetent, corrupt, and spends all its time stumbling from one crisis to another. The White House quickly responded with a press statement saying, "Once again, we have achieved our objective of creating a government over there that's just like ours." Okay, fine. All right, we're doing good here. There have been, we're back to the Tony part of the speech. There have been many reasons for what I think is the new distance between America and Europe, this new distance between old friends. Not all the reasons are political or geopolitical. Some are at once bigger and more basic. I have been thinking, as I thought about George the past few weeks, I've been thinking about an interview I did a dozen years ago with George's good friend, Richard John Newhouse. The subject of the entire interview is the intersection of faith and politics. We had been discussing Aristotle's definition of politics, one of the earliest such recorded definitions, certainly among the simplest and most direct. Aristotle defined politics as the art of free persons deliberating the question, how ought we to order our lives together? In the conversation we had about 12 years ago, Father Newhouse made the point that ought, in Aristotle's formulation, suggested that politics is, or at least should be, a moral enterprise. Obviously, by this, he did not mean to suggest that all politicians, political decisions, political stands, or ways of persuading in the political sphere are moral. But when you get right down to it, any serious political question is a moral question because it deals with justice, equality, fairness, all of which are moral categories. When you try to take such things, such categories, out of political life, you wind up with a thin, insubstantial, less compelling, less relevant, and ultimately less serious politics, which is another way of saying you wind up with the Constitution of the European Union. Oh, thank you. In America, there remains an active sense for all our disagreements and disputes on the subject. There remains an active sense that it is good and necessary to include in the debate, to embrace in the debate, to have as a major part of the debate those whose faith informs, enriches their insights. And not only believers, of course, we need all who care about truth and reason. George Weigel's work reminds us of the importance of truth and reason to the continued vitality of democratic society, and even to its continued ability to endure. He warns, if the West's culture, high and low, continues to embrace postmodernist assumptions in which everybody has their own truth, it may feel fine and pleasant in the day-to-day for a while, but if the West forgets what it has long believed and why it has long believed it, the West will not be able to defend itself in, for instance, its current struggle against Islamist extremism and terror. George recently wrote that without the foundations of truth and reason, the West won't be able to give the reasons why its commitment to civility, tolerance, human rights, the rule of law are worth defending. He said, a Western world that strips itself of its convictions about the truths that make Western civilization possible cannot even make a useful contribution to a genuine dialogue of civilizations. Why? Because any such conversation must be based on a shared understanding that human beings can, however imperfectly, in however flawed and limited a way, come to know the truth of things. I believe these are all important ideas. They have never been so timely or so needed. And tonight, therefore, I ask you to help me welcome one of their great proponents in our time, George Weigel.
Good evening. Thank you for the honor of inviting me to deliver the 20th Riston Lecture. Walter Riston was, as Henry Kissinger eulogized him, the type of American who has made this country the hope of the world. Let us all be grateful tonight for Walter Riston's love of freedom, for his faith in the power of ideas, and for his public-spirited generosity. And let us try in our own ways to emulate his example. At the outset of my remarks this evening, let me also thank the trustees of the Manhattan Institute and President Larry Mohn for their invitation, and my friend Peggy Noonan for her characteristically kind introduction. Since you've already proven yourself a very tough audience by not laughing at Peggy's jokes, I will spare you the ritual opening joke, because there's no way I'm going to compete with her, and get on to the business at hand. For years now, what seems to be a growing political gap between the United States and its cultural parent, Europe, has been a staple of transatlantic discussion and debate. This widening of the Atlantic is usually discussed in terms of policy differences, differences over prosecuting the war against jihadist terrorism, differences over the UN's role in world affairs, differences over the Kyoto Protocol, differences over Iraq. Those policy differences are real, and as Robert Kagan has suggested, they reflect the dramatically different experiences that Europe and America had in the 20th century. Permit me to suggest tonight, however, that attempts to parse these differences in political, strategic, or economic terms alone will ultimately fail, because such explanations don't reach deeply enough into the human texture of contemporary Europe. If I may state my thesis in the indicative rather than the subjunctive, Europe, and especially Western Europe, is suffering from a crisis of civilizational morale. The most dramatic manifestation of that crisis is not to be found in Europe's fondness for governmental bureaucracy or for fiscally shaky healthcare schemes and pension plans. Nor is the drama of the crisis captured fully by the appeasement mentality that some European leaders display toward jihadist terrorism, most recently, of course, in the Danish cartoons controversy, and even more recently, the cancellation of a performance of Mozart's Idomeneo by the Berlin State Opera. No, the most dramatic manifestation of Europe's crisis of civilizational morale is the fact that Europe is depopulating itself. Several decades of below replacement level birth rates have created situations that would have been literally unimaginable when what we now know as the European Union was taking its first institutional baby steps in the late 1940s and early 1950s. By the middle of this century, some demographers estimate, 60% of the Italian people will have no personal experience of a brother, a sister, an aunt, an uncle, or a cousin. Germany in that same period will likely lose the equivalent of the entire population of the former East Germany, and Spain's population will decline by almost one quarter. Europe, in other words, is depopulating itself in numbers not seen since the Black Death of the 14th century. One result of these unprecedented demographics is a Europe that, in British historian Neil Ferguson's striking term, is increasingly senescent. And senescence is not, to put it gently, a condition conducive to political vigor. Yet the issue, as I suggested a moment ago, goes far deeper than politics. When an entire continent, healthier, wealthier, and more secure than ever before, fails to create the human future in the most elemental sense by creating the next generation, something very serious is afoot. It is neither unfair nor Europhobic, nor isolationist, to call that something a crisis of civilizational morale. Understanding its origins is important in itself. It is also critically important for Americans. Why? Because some of the acids that have eaten away at European culture over the past two centuries are at work in the United States, and indeed throughout the West, at a time when another civilizational enterprise with a far different vision of the future is contesting with the West for the definition of that future, often in aggressive ways. Probing to the roots of Europe's crisis of civilizational morale requires us to think about history in a fresh way. Europeans and Americans alike typically think of history as the product of politics, the contest for power, or economics, the quest for wealth, or some combination of politics and economics. Both history as politics and history as economics take a partial truth and try unsuccessfully to turn it into a comprehensive truth. Understanding Europe's current situation and what it means for America requires us to look at history in a different way, to look at history through the prism of culture. At the beginning of the 20th century, Europe was the acknowledged center of world civilization. Yet within 50 years, that same Europe produced two world wars, three totalitarian systems, a Cold War that threatened global disaster, oceans of blood, mountains of corpses, the Gulag, and Auschwitz. What happened? Perhaps more to the point, why had what happened happened? Political and economic analyses don't offer fully satisfactory answers to those questions. Cultural answers, which is to say spiritual answers, perhaps even theological answers, might help. Take, for example, the proposal made by a French Jesuit, Henri de Lubac, in 1942. De Lubac argued that Europe's torments in the 1940s were the result of a constellation of defective ideas, which he summarized under the rubric atheistic humanism, the deliberate rejection of the God of the Bible in the name of human liberation. This, de Lubac suggested, was something entirely new. Biblical man had perceived his relationship to the God of Abraham, Moses, and Jesus as a liberation. Liberation from the terrors of gods who demanded extortionate sacrifice, liberation from the whims of gods who played games with human lives, as in the Iliad and the Odyssey, liberation from the vagaries of fate. The God of the Bible was different, and because biblical man believed that he could have access to the one true God through prayer and worship, he believed, or came to believe, that history could be bent in a more humane direction, and that it was man's responsibility to do so. One of European civilization's most distinctive cultural characteristics is its conviction that life isn't just one damn thing after another about which little or nothing can be done. Europe learned that, I suggest, from its faith in the God of the Bible. Several of the most significant figures in 19th century European high culture turned this inside out and upside down, however. Human freedom and human greatness meant rejecting the biblical God, according to such influential thinkers as Auguste Comte, Ludwig Feuerbach, Cardinal Karl Marx, and Friedrich Nietzsche. And here, Father de Lubac argued, were ideas with consequences. For when you marry modern technology to Comte's positivism, Feuerbach's subjectivism, Marx's materialism, and Nietzsche's will to power, what you get, he suggested, are the great mid-20th century tyrannies, communism, fascism, Nazism. The same point has been made more recently by the English historian Michael Burley in two important new studies, Earthly Powers and most recently Sacred Causes. Burley, following de Lubac, argues ultra-mundane humanism in its quest for a worldly utopia is inevitably inhuman humanism. The first explosive result of this profound shift in European high culture was World War I. For the Great War, not only in its origins, as described by David Fromkin in Europe's Last Summer, but even more in its mindless continuation, after the impossibility of a rapid military resolution was plainly obvious to all, that was the lethal byproduct of a crisis of civilizational morality, a failure of moral reason in a culture that had given the world the very idea of moral reason. That crisis of moral reason led to the crisis of civilizational morale that is much with us, and especially with Europe today. This crisis, I suggest, could only become fully visible after the end of the Cold War. Its effects were first masked by the illusory peace of the interwar period, then by the rise of totalitarianism and the Great Depression, then by the Second World War itself, then by the Cold War. It was only after 1991, when the 77-year-long European Civil War that had begun with the guns of August 1914 had ended, that the long-term effects of what Alexander Solzhenitsyn once called Europe's rage of self-mutilation came to the surface of history and could be seen for what they are. Europe is experiencing a crisis of civilizational morale today because of what happened in Europe 90 years ago and because of what paved the way culturally for that political catastrophe. The damage done to the fabric of European culture and civilization in the Great War could only be seen clearly when the Great War's political effects had been cleared from the board in 1991. Contemporary Europe, of course, is not bedeviled by the rawest forms of de Lubach's atheistic humanism. The Second World War and the Cold War settled that by putting an end to fascism, German National Socialism, and Marxism-Leninism. Europe today is profoundly shaped, however, by a kindler, gentler cousin, what the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor has termed exclusive humanism, a set of ideas and political default positions according to which, and in the name of democracy, human rights, tolerance, and civility, all transcendent religious or moral reference points must be kept out of European public life, especially the life of the European Union. This conviction led to two recent episodes that tell us a lot about Europe's crisis of civilizational morale and where that crisis can lead politically. The first episode involved the drafting of a new constitutional treaty to govern the now 25-member European Union. That process, in turn, set off a raucous argument over whether the Euro Constitution's preamble should acknowledge Christianity as one of the sources of European civilization and of contemporary Europe's commitment to human rights and democracy. The debate was sometimes silly, not infrequently bitter, and was finally resolved in favor of Taylor's exclusive humanism. A treaty of some 400 pages and some 70,000 words could not find room for one word, Christianity. Yet while following this debate, I had the uncomfortable sense that the real argument was not about the past, but about the future. Would religiously informed moral argument have any place in the European public square? A disturbing answer to that question came in October 2004, when Rocco Buttiglione, a distinguished Italian philosopher then serving as Minister for European Affairs in the Italian government, was nominated as the European Union Commissioner of Justice. Professor Buttiglione, who would have been considered an adornment of any sane government between Cato the Elder and October 2004, was then subjected to a nasty inquisition during which numerous members of the European Parliament made it unpleasantly clear that Buttiglione's convictions about the nature of marriage disqualified him from holding high office on the European Commission, despite Buttiglione's sworn commitment, substantiated by a lifetime of work, to uphold and defend everyone's civil rights. Buttiglione ultimately withdrew when it became clear that too many Europarlamentarians agreed with one of their number who claimed that Buttiglione's moral convictions, not any actions he had undertaken or would undertake, but his convictions were, quote, in direct contradiction of European law. Convictions in direct contradiction of European law. Buttiglione described this to a British newspaper as the new totalitarianism, which is not, I fear, an exaggeration. 6 months after the Buttiglione affair came to its disgraceful end, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger described the same phenomenon as the dictatorship of relativism in his sermon opening the papal conclave of 2005. That this new dictatorship marches under the banner of tolerance only makes matters worse. But from whence does it spring? One of Europe's wisest men, the French philosopher Rémy Brague, wrote recently that while the 19th century had been the century of good and evil, with the social question posed by the Industrial Revolution dominating public life, and the 20th century had been the century of truth and falsehood, as great ideological systems contended for the human future, the 21st century would be the century of being or nothingness. A nihilism that had soured on the very mystery of being itself had settled like a thick fog over European high culture, Professor Brague suggested. That nihilism was informed by a deep skepticism about the human capacity to know the truth of anything with certainty, and it had given rise to a moral relativism which had eaten away at Europe's capacity to give an account of its commitments to freedom and justice, civility and tolerance. The net result of this witch's brew, Rémy Brague proposed, could only be a politics of coercion, for the arts of democratic persuasion could not function in a cultural climate marked by nihilism, skepticism, and relativism. Thus, Buttiglione's new totalitarianism or Ratzinger's dictatorship of relativism are real and present dangers, and the struggle to resist them defines one pole of Europe's bipolar culture war. Europe's other culture war is brought into focus by the relentlessness of Europe's demographics. To repeat, the wasting disease that has beset this once greatest of civilizations is not physical, but rather a disease in the realm of the human spirit. The Orthodox theologian David Hart, in a variant on Rémy Brague's theme, has called it the disease of metaphysical boredom. Boredom with the mystery, passion, and adventure of life itself. Europe, in Hart's image, is boring itself to death. And that is having the most profound strategic consequences. For while Europe is boring itself to death, it is allowing 21st century jihadists, who regard their military defeats at Poitiers in 732, Lepanto in 1571, and Vienna in 1683, as well as their expulsion from Spain in 1492, as temporary reversals en route to Islam's final triumph in Europe. That boringness of European life is allowing those jihadists to imagine that the day of victory is not far off. Not because Europe will be conquered by an invading army marching under the green banners of the prophet, but because Europe, having culturally disarmed itself to the point where it cannot give a robust account of its commitments to human rights, democracy, and the rule of law, and having depopulated itself out of the boredom that is an ever-present danger in what Zbigniew Brzezinski once called modernity's permissive cornucopia, will have handed the future over to those immigrants and their children and grandchildren who wish to make Europe a cultural and political extension of the Arab Islamic world. Should that happen, the irony would be unmistakable. The drama of an exclusivist humanism emptying Europe of its soul would have played itself out in the triumph of a thoroughly non-humanistic theism. Europe's contemporary crisis of civilizational morale would reach its bitter conclusion when Notre Dame becomes Hagia Sophia on the Seine, a great Christian church become an Islamic museum. At which point, we may be sure, the human rights proclaimed by those exclusivist humanists who insist that a culture's spiritual aspirations have nothing to do with its politics, those human rights would be in very, very serious trouble indeed. It need not happen. There are signs of spiritual and cultural renewal in Europe, especially among young people. The most influential of contemporary European philosophers, Jürgen Habermas, who once defended a hard form of exclusivist humanism, now argues that a humane and democratic politics requires a foundation built of moral norms that we can know to be true. The Buttiglione affair has raised alarms about the new intolerance that masquerades in the name of tolerance. The brutal murder of Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh by a middle-class Dutch Moroccan, the July 7, 2005 bombings in London, and the depredations attendant on the Danish cartoons controversy have reminded Europeans that root causes don't really explain jihadist ideology or jihadist terrorism. Perhaps most importantly and most positively, the outlines of a new European conversation that challenges the sterilities of exclusivist humanism while engaging both believers and non-believers has come into focus in the past year thanks to the collaborative work of Joseph Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict XVI, and Marcello Pera, a non-believer and philosopher of science who was a member of the Italian Senate and was, until the recent change of government in Italy, the Senate's president. In a jointly authored book published in the United States recently, titled Without Roots, Ratzinger and Pera advanced strikingly similar analyses of Europe's crisis of civilizational morale, the roots of which both located in a loss of faith in reason, including moral reason. Moral reason being one of the distinctive characteristics of the culture that arose from the meeting in what we now know as Europe of Jerusalem, Athens, and Rome. Moreover, these two distinguished intellectuals agreed in a variant on Arnold Toynbee's theory of historical change that a creative minority of men and women convinced that the truths the West lives politically are truths susceptible to rational defense, that creative minority can be the agents of Europe's rebirth as a culturally self-confident civilization capable of giving an account of its democratic political aspirations, which is to say, a civilization willing to face squarely and respond imaginatively to the threat posed by the aggressive elements of the far different civilizational project now housed within it. Indeed, now that the dust has settled after Pope Benedict's recent lecture at Regensburg, perhaps we can see that Benedict, in cooperation with men like the non-believer Pera, has given the world a vocabulary through which a discussion of the sources and threat of jihadist ideology can be engaged by believers and non-believers alike and without falling into the trap of xenophobia, namely the vocabulary of rationality and irrationality. If Europe begins to recover its faith in reason, then at least some in Europe may, in time, rediscover the reasonableness of faith. And in any event, a renewed faith in reason would provide an antidote to metaphysical boredom and thus open the prospect of a new birth of freedom and a new birth of culture in Europe. Europe's current distress is a reminder to all of us who are Europe transplanted and who should feel a deep filial piety toward Europe because of that, a reminder that societies and cultures are only as great as their spiritual aspirations. It is not an act of ingratitude toward the achievements of the Enlightenment to suggest that the soul-withering secularism, the exclusivist humanism that has grown out of one stream of Enlightenment thought threatens the future of the West precisely because it prevents us from giving an account to ourselves and our children and our grandchildren, as well as to our enemies, of the noble political ends embodied in the Western democratic tradition. As Marcello Pera put it in Without Roots, absolute worldliness, supposing there is such a thing, is an absolute vacuum in which neither the happy majority nor the creative minorities can exist. For a people whose democratic birth certificate begins with the assertion of self-evident moral truths built into the human condition by nature and nature's God, Professor Pera's brave words should be taken not as an elegy for Europe, but as a call to renewal for us all, a moral and cultural call to arms. Thank you.
Can we get some? First, can we get a glass of water up here for George? He's talked quite a bit. It's now 9:25. We're supposed to adjourn at 9:30. I'm going to extend it to 9:35, which gives us 10 minutes for some questions. So, what I ask you to do is raise your hand. I will acknowledge you, and then wait for the microphone to reach you. Let's see, Heather. Why don't we go first question?
Mr. Weigel, the violent crime rate in the United States, above all homicide, is many magnitudes higher than in Europe. Isn't respect for the law one of the prime elements of civilizational morale? And do you have any examples of a breakdown in respect for the rule of law in Europe that doesn't apply here? For instance, are contracts breached more often in Scandinavia than in Mississippi?
Haven't been in either one recently, so I'm not sure. The breakdown of the rule of law, it seems to me, in Europe is happening at a macro level that should be deeply disturbing. There are entire areas of Great Britain, of France, of the Netherlands, perhaps of Germany, although we know less about that, in which the writ of local law does not run and Sharia law prevails with respect to forced marriages, with respect to all sorts of other violations of civil liberties, and with respect to honor killings, which are simply not prosecuted. So it seems to me that that creation of extraterritorial enclaves in which another civilizational enterprise with no concept of the rule of law, as we understand it, unfolding in significant parts of Western Europe is a real problem. So that's what occurs to me when I hear rule of law and crisis of civilizational morale. Nothing of what I said tonight, I hope, will be interpreted as a call to complacency in the United States. As I indicated, at least in passing at the beginning, those cultural acids that seem to have had some significant role in the present circumstances of European society and culture are present in our own society and culture as well. One reason why your new higher education project strikes me as such an important one. It's very difficult to go to a philosophy department in a prestigious American university today and find anyone on a faculty willing to make the argument that there is such a thing as the truth rather than your truth or my truth or whatever. This kind of epistemological insouciance only leads to deep, deep trouble over time. That doesn't reach the problem of the urban underclass and its breakdown of civilizational morale and morality, but it does suggest an area where your own work here at the Manhattan Institute is going to go forward in a very important way.
David?
Yes, Dr. Glazer, I'm just an amateur in philosophy. I'm a great fan of William James, and I'm sure he would be tremendously on your side in terms of the importance of religion in stimulating people's verve and feeling about life. And in fact, I'm sure he would be unbelievably impressed by linking up the population growth to a lack of enthusiasm stimulated by a lack of religion. But he would differ from you, I think, in terms of saying that the religious path is the only one or even the best one toward truth. He would say that you need competition of approaches. You need approaches of men who believe in faith, but you also need competitions of men who are skeptical and want to challenge that and so on. So I would ask you, in the United States today, which was established by very religious feeling men, they put in the, what is it called, the clause, the establishment clause, which made clear that the government should separate itself from establishing any religion. And that is more or less held out to today. So anybody can preach a religion. Wouldn't you say the United States has sort of hit the optimum situation?
I would judge historically that the liberation of the churches and the synagogue from the potentially lethal embrace of the state has been very, very good for religion in America. The constitutional prohibition on a federal church has been very, very good for the practice of religion in America, and I think in part what we're seeing played out in the crisis of European secularism is the unfortunate aftermath of a far too close embrace between church and state in Europe over far too many centuries. So the liberation of the church from the possibility of having its truth claims buttressed by coercive state power has been very good for religious life in America. That goes or should go without further ado. Let me underscore that I am not suggesting that the religious path to truth is the only path to truth. I think, for example, of my friend, whom I cited here tonight, Marcello Pera, who says, somewhat whimsically, somewhat sadly, that he's incapable of the act of faith. That's a sadness to me, but it hasn't prevented him from being a man of reason, a man of civility, a man who can make really persuasive arguments for the moral truths that undergird the Western experiment in democratic self-governance. It's the coalition between those who believe in reason from a non-religiously believing point of view and those who believe in the power of reason whose ideas are also informed by religious faith, but who both believe in the capacity of reason to get at the truth of things. That is the coalition that will, I believe, save the West if the West is to be saved. It is not that irrationality or post-rationality, of which I might add the Pope also warned at Regensburg. If Regensburg was a very important moment in identifying for the world, as I said, a vocabulary, rationality, irrationality, to deal with the jihadist threat, and if it reminded us that distorted ideas of God can have terribly lethal real-world consequences, it was also a challenge to Europe that a lack of faith in reason can lead to a kind of quicksand pit of incomprehension that ultimately leads, I think the Pope would agree, to this condition of spiritual or metaphysical boredom in which the very mystery of life itself no longer presents itself to us as the exhilarating and exciting and thing capable of calling forth reverence, however we would define reverence within each one of us. That's the other side of the problem. If an unreasonable faith, if a faith in which God is understood to be capable of commanding the irrational, namely the death of innocence, if that's one side of the present world historical problem, the other side is a lack of faith in reason, which leads to a kind of insouciance about the future, which is no way to create an ongoing civilizational enterprise.
Byron Lee, just wait for the microphone.
I'm a little confused about where I stand here. I guess I have a two-part question. The first part is this. Can you cite an historical set of facts that where a civilization has seen a significant erosion in spiritual values, where that has been reversed? And if that is the case in the United States, how is that to be reversed? And the reason that I'm confused is that I recently read Sam Harris's book about how religion is a dangerous force in American society and how we should resist its influences. So how can you let me leave this hotel with a reconciliation of those conflicting forces?
I'm not sure there is any reconciliation with the Sam Harrises of this world who, there's joint political work on matters that we could agree upon politically, but that book is such a caricature of religious faith and of its real impact on American public life that it's hard to imagine what you would have a serious conversation with him about on that. Are there moments of renewal of spiritual values that we could cite? Sure. Throughout the history of Christianity in Europe, there are wave after wave of reform and renewal movements, which in some instances burst out of Europe and reshaped the future of the world. In 1900, there were 10 million Christians in Africa, most of them in Egypt and Ethiopia. By the middle of this century, there will be almost 480 million Christians in Africa. That's because, in part, a process of spiritual revitalization in Europe in the 19th century burst the bounds of Europe and created the great missionary enterprises in Africa in the 19th and 20th centuries. In our own circumstance, I think it's perhaps less a question of of a profound period of spiritual corruption or malaise being turned around, as of America being called by religious conviction, by people of religious conviction, back to the truth about itself. And that, of course, the most evident to hand immediate example is the civil rights movement in its classic period, 40s, 50s, early 60s, almost entirely motored out of the American religious community, making an explicit appeal not to America with a K, but to the best in the American creed, if you will, and leading a genuine process, I believe, of national moral renewal. The silliness and indeed the human tragedy that Juan Williams describes in his remarkable and brave new book, Enough, should not blind us to the fact that for a period of some 20 years, America went through a process of genuine moral renewal, which has profoundly changed the face of this society, and for the better. And that was a renewal led in the main by men and women of faith, and in many cases by clergymen. That's not the only way to do these things, but that's one relevant example, it seems to me, of the capacity of this culture, of which we are the custodians, to be self-renewing on its own best terms.
Thank you, George. I wish we had more time, but I think we have to adjourn at this point. Thank you. Thank you all for coming.